The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is case 36 from the Blue Cliff Record. Changsha wandering in the mountains. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, Master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned, following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the scents of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." Zhui Do added the remark, "Thanks for your reply." So according to the U.S. calendar, spring will start Friday, this coming Friday. According to the lunar calendar, spring started a couple of weeks ago on February 17th. And so here we are in this moment that is spring and not quite spring all at the same time. We had some lovely warm days and then the frost returned and we find ourselves in that interesting moment that Basho captures so well when he says, just enough snow to tilt the daffodil. So in the spirit of this spring, this emerging spring, let's examine this koan together that gives us the very essence of springtime. So I like to say these days that the ancient Chan teachers are Chinese ancestors from the Tang Dynasty, and Changsha is one of these. He was a contemporary of Zhao Zhou and a student of Nan Chuan. So our earlier Chan teachers left us three really important practices that we continue today. And one of those, of course, is sitting meditation, which they wouldn't have called Zazen since that's a Japanese term, but sitting meditation. And interestingly enough, the Chan teachers say very little about Zazen. You don't find detailed instructions for sitting meditation. You don't find much at all. It's not mentioned much in the koan literature. And I would say Alan Watts in The Way of Zen, which was the introduction for some of us in my generation to Zen, Alan Watts said, well, they didn't really do that much sitting meditation. He didn't like to do sitting meditation himself. No. I think it's not mentioned because it's just so taken for granted. It's one of those things that goes without saying. It didn't need special attention. Sitting meditation, after all, is what Bodhidharma did for years facing a wall in a cave. Sitting meditation is what we see in many Chinese images of the Buddha. So yes, that was a key practice. And we continue that today in our Zazen. And a second of these practices that the Chan ancestors left us and that we carry on is work practice, what the Japanese would call samu, what Esther pointed us towards this morning in terms of caretaking our spaces. And the very first all-Chan monastery, the very first monastery that was just for Chan practitioners was Baizhang's mountain monastery. And Baizhang is famous for having said, a day of no working is a day of no eating. So work practice was essential to early Chan. And we have various koans that talk about this or that practitioner having an awakening experience while working. This actually goes way back before Baizhang to the very first generation of Chan teachers with Mahasattva Fu, our great lay ancestor, who had his awakening experience when he was plowing his fields. So that's is something that we continue in our Samu practice on when we do residential sesshin and in our home caretaking practice. I hope that you do your home caretaking practice in the spirit that this is one of the great practices bequeathed to us by our Chan ancestors. How can you really do justice to that? Not just during the sesshin, but whenever you've got a chore to do. This is a great opportunity. And the third practice, not so much emphasized these days, but it's one that I call wandering. And it's one that's illustrated so beautifully and so powerfully by this koan. Our Chan ancestors did plenty of wandering. And this too comes up in stories about them. Most of the Chan, early Chan monasteries were not in urban areas, but they were in the mountains, away from all the problems that come with urbanity and with the authorities, that the town authorities that grow up in urban places. Chan, early Chan teachers didn't want to have to deal with that. And they also clearly loved the mountain scenery, the mountain atmosphere. And so they located there. Any teacher whose name includes Shan, like Yang Shan or De Shan, were named for their mountain monasteries. Shan, as you know, means mountain in Chinese. So this is how integral mountain settings were to early Zen practice in China. And going from one monastery to another, which is usually where they went, would involve walking along mountain trails, would involve walking along mountain paths, wandering along these paths. When we have residential sesshin, if you've set residential sesshin with us, you've heard the shakujo, that staff with rings at the top of it that makes a jangling noise. And that is descended from the staffs that our Chan ancestors would use in the mountains to warn off wild animals. The mountains were wild places in ancient China. There were tigers, there were bears. And so just as people use bear bells today sometimes when they're hiking in the mountains, the Chan teachers had these shakujos, although again, that's a Japanese term. By the way, I do not advise using bear bells because it turns out bears can't hear them. The bells are out of their hearing range. The loud conversation is much better. just passing that along in case. I don't want to be responsible for anyone being pursued by a bear. So wandering in the mountains. One more word about that before we go back to the koan, and that's that if you've encountered this koan in our koan curriculum, you may be saying to yourself, but it's not Changsha wandering in the mountains, it's Changsha picnicking. Changsha goes picnicking. That is the only translation that uses that term. Every other translation, including the Cleary translation that I read from, says wandering in the mountains. The picnicking is John Terrence's choice, and John Terrence is an Australian, and Australians have a very different sense of picnicking than Americans do. You can ask about that later if you want, but the important thing is that this koan is not about food. Changsha doesn't say, first I found a nice flat rock and had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and some cold tea. And then I came back munching on gorp that I'd put in the sleeves of my robe. Not that at all. This is about wandering in the mountains. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. So what is wandering in the mountains? What is this activity, this essential activity of wandering in the mountains? What does it mean to wander as opposed to hike or to go from one place to another? I mentioned that our Chan ancestors did do a great deal of wandering on mountain paths, but if they were going from one monastery to another, was it really wandering? Well, what's the difference between going someplace and wandering someplace? Is it possible to wander to the store and back rather than to go to the store and back? I want to leave that with you as a kind of sub-koan for you to sit with. Can you wander to the store? I think that you can, and I would advise it. What would wandering involve? Wandering would involve not going as quickly and efficiently as possible, not taking the shortest route, but taking the route that exposes you to as many of the 10,000 things as you are willing to encounter. The route that allows you to go a little slower and take in your surroundings, take in everything, take in the smells, the sights, the sounds, take in the feeling of the air, take in the feeling of the ground, grass, pavement, whatever comes up as you walk on it. Keeping in mind that our ancestors were walking in straw sandals probably gave them a better sense of what they were stepping on than if they had thick-soled boots. So this wandering, this is the wandering that Yangjia points to at the beginning of the song on realizing the Tao that we read together a little while ago. There is the leisurely one, walking the Tao beyond philosophy. So up in the mountains, where one can feel the flow of things, away from the built environment, away from the noise of crowds, of urban things. And yet, this is my experience, and I know some of your experience too, that going to the wilder places, not entirely wild, any place with a trail or a path isn't entirely wild, but going to the wilder places can open us up to the flow, to the Tao. But of course, you can be the leisurely one walking the Tao anywhere, walking around your home, walking around your yard, walking around your block. This is always available to us as a way of taking in our environment, as a way of moving through our environment. But how lovely when we actually do get to be in a wilder place, on the beach, in the mountains, in a desert, here in the mountains. So one day Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, so now he's back to the monastery in the foothills. When he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" So many of our koans begin with a question like that. Where are you coming from? This is often the first question a teacher asks a newcomer. Where are you coming from? And as we know, this is a way of saying, show me your mind. One of our readings advises us to encounter Zen teachers and show them your mind. So where have you been? Where are you coming from? Tell me about it. Let's look into this. And in this case, this is not a teacher beginning an entry interview with a student or checking out a wandering monk, maybe a wandering home leaver who's had an awakening experience and is now going from teacher to test that experience. This is the temple director, the head monk, asking for some kind of instruction from Changsha. Tell me about this. Tell me where you've been. I'm open to your teaching. Where are you coming? This translation says, where are you coming from, master? We might say, where are you coming from, teacher? Shah said, from wandering in the mountains. Again, maybe that's all that needs to be said. Maybe the temple director understands, wandering in the mountains in the way that I've been trying to evoke it for us, in this way of a deep form of practice that extends our practice on the cushion in a different direction, that takes us out of the Zendo, out of the Dharma hall, through the Dharma gate, through the monastery gate, and into the wilder places of our lives, where we encounter the Tao just as surely as we encounter it on the cushion. Adding to that, that this encounter with the Tao that can happen when we're wandering in the mountains is not separate from what happens on the cushion or what happens on the chair. I was noticing, as I thought about this koan, that I can't think of a koan or story from the ancient Chan era where anyone has an awakening experience while they're doing sitting meditation. And again, there are very few examples even of people doing sitting meditation. We know that they did it, but you can't find very many instances of it. But I couldn't find any of an awakening experience on the cushion, as opposed to several awakening experiences in wandering. But that doesn't mean that the sitting on the cushion did not make this experience possible. So the more we sit on the cushion, I would say, or on our chairs, the more likely we are to have the kind of experience that Changsha is pointing towards here, when he tells the temple director, the head monk, quite simply, from wandering in the mountains. But the temple director wants a little more. The head monk wants a little more. We can appreciate that. So the head monk asks, "Where did you go?" The head monk asks, "Tell me more about this. I'd like to hear a little bit more about this wandering in the mountains as you experience." And then this gorgeous part of the koan that just goes straight to our hearts, I hope. Changsha said, "First I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers." So this again points to what it means to wander rather than to walk straight from one place to another. What path did he follow? He followed the path of the fragrant grasses. He followed them up the mountain, enjoying that scent. I love the turning to a sense that we often neglect, or at least neglect to talk about, the sense of smell. We are animals who are dominated by the visual sense. We have this big visual cortex in our brains, takes up about half of the neocortex, our visual system. But we've got this ancient olfactory bulb that is one of the more primitive parts of the brain that links us to other animals. And that can be very powerful, as you know, if you've had a deja vu experience when you've smelled a certain smell. Smells arouse us, smells warn us, smells very deep in us. And then this lovely smell of spring. Spring is the time when we start to smell again outside. The snow and the ice have locked in a lot of the smells of the outdoors for throughout the winter. And now the snows have melted, the ice is gone, and we can smell again. We smell these fragrant grasses that are newly growing, that are greening up, that are wafting their smells into the air. What a lovely way to move through the world. Smelling these grasses. The grasses, of course, also make us think in a Zen context, in a Chan context, of the 10,000 things, the 100 grasses, the 10,000, the 10,000 leagues of grass. the 10,000 things. So not just grasses, but everything. Everything that Changsha encounters has this fragrance of spring. Everything is imbued with this sense of coming alive. Of course, spring also makes us think of awakening. And that's there too. Although this is not a koan about Changsha's awakening experience that clearly happened earlier. This is a koan expressing, celebrating, conveying what it is to be an awakened person wandering in the mountains, what post-enlightenment practice is. It's wandering in the mountains. That's exactly what it is. And then I return following the falling flowers. So there's a springing up and there's a falling as well. Something to notice. This falling of the blossoms, the early blossoms. Robert Frost, in his beautiful sonnet, The Oven Bird, calls this the early petal fall. And then he says later in the poem, then comes that other fall we name the fall. So there's the fall already in the petal fall. Petal fall is really savored in Japan and China. I was watching a K-drama recently, and they were featuring walking through these lanes with cherry petals falling on them. So beautiful. So the plum blossoms and the cherry blossoms fall on us in mid-spring, the early petal fall. Also, how lovely, but how important that there's a note that there's not just springing up in this koan, but there's also falling away. And that takes us to the next part of the koan. The head monk says, how very much like the sense of springtime. The head monk is appreciating this, is bowing to it, is receiving Changsha's teaching. But maybe not entirely receiving it, because it's not just the sense of springtime. And so then Changsha, I would say, kind of teases him a little when he says, it even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses. Suddenly we have the mind of comparison, the mind of differences. Yes, oh yes, this spring even surpasses the autumn. Is that true? Do we think that? Do we think that spring is better than autumn? Do we think that scented grasses and falling blossoms are better than the dew on the lotus flowers in the autumn cool? I don't think we do. I resist that. I wonder if this is the subtlest kind of little reproach to the head monk, who hasn't understood that Changsha is talking about what Shundo Aoyama talks about when she says spring anywhere, anytime. That this is a spring that extends throughout the year. This is a spring that includes the fall, that includes the falling blossoms. This is not a spring that excludes the fall. This is fall is not a failure to continue spring. Spring is not an early attempt at fall, right? Spring is fully spring, and fall is fully fall, and yet spring also includes this petal fall, and fall also includes spring-like moments. And so haiku writers like to evoke the chrysanthemum, that flower which blooms in autumn, that spring that inheres within fall, just as fall inheres within spring. So this is our koan. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned, following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew, dripping on the lotuses." Zhui Do, much later, added the remark, "Thank you for your reply. Thank you for your attention." So please feel free to relax your posture and come forward in Dharma dialogue. I encourage you to respond not only to the koan, but to anything that it evoked for you, to spring, to wandering, also anything that's coming up for you about this sesshin, about our practice, open to whatever is in your heart and in your mind at this moment. And I will ask Dharma Holder Paul and Dharma Holder Michael to help me in responding to you. So looking for Zoom hands. And yeah, we begin with Chad.
Thank you for the talk. Yeah, a lot arises for me, and I love the wandering as a term, because it sort of evokes this feeling of softening to the unknown and a curiousness. And it often then leads to my walking with my dog and where his little nose takes him. I never know, but I always try to think of it as, you know, what is this little adventure that we're on this time, and what comes out of it?
Yeah, isn't that wonderful how your dog can become your Zen teacher at those moments? Because the dog is so fully alive to its environment, so happy to be outside. I walk a lot in Waltham on the local trails and paths, and I meet lots of dog walkers, and I almost always smile when I see these dogs that are, even if the person walking the dog has the headphones on and they're sealed off and they're talking on their phone and they could be anywhere, the dog is 100% present. And the fact that they're taking the world in a way that we can't, but in a way that inspires us to do what we can. We don't have their noses, but they don't have our color vision. And so it seems to all even out. Yeah, lovely. Nice that you have this dog to step in as your Zen teacher when you're away from the Sangha.
I appreciate you using the word softening, Chad. Mm-hmm. That is really, I think it speaks a lot to what Alan was saying about wandering to the grocery store. Because wandering to the grocery store doesn't necessarily mean taking more time to get there and going a circuitous route that takes you off path. It's a softening of your heart. Mm-hmm. It's opening to what's here along the way, as opposed to having a direct outcome that you keep in your mind, closing off everything else. It's an opening to the world. And then you can still go wandering to the grocery store, but you're opening to your life. You're opening to whatever's arising. And maybe something else calls you instead of going to the grocery store. But maybe you'll get right there directly. It doesn't matter. It's what your heart and your mind is open to.
Brad.
I appreciated the mention of sight and smell, I think Esther mentioned it before we broke for a home practiced smelling things. I'm not sure anymore about that, but I noticed myself in making my usual oatmeal that I was paying more attention Oh, I think it was sounds, and suddenly I was hearing the sound of this and the sound of that in a more clear way. And the wandering to me, I mean, oatmeal's my regular breakfast done in the usual way, but there's so much space in all of my actions and all of the things I see and all of the, even in the order of things, to play around a little bit. And that feels like wandering. So the grocery store is like that too. Maybe if there's two left lanes to turn at that intersection, maybe I'll take the other one next time, even though it means I have to merge, you know, just playing around. And I've also really liked the idea of not parking at the closest space to give somebody else that and have a little more wandering time. So, but the senses are real important to me and a way to bring me into the moment to pay a lot of attention to that. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Brad. I love that about parking a little further away. And so two gifts, the gift to the person who maybe has mobility issues and needs the closer space, and the gift to yourself of having a longer walk. And as you were speaking about walking to the store, I thought about too, when you're in the grocery store, you know, you can be very efficient, and or you can wander the aisles and notice this and that and take in the sights and smells of the grocery store. I used to love going to the store with my parents, with my mom or my dad when I was a kid. It was the supermarket was like this amazing place, and it still can be.
Yeah, and Brad, I so appreciate you highlighting this kind of everyday experience as well. You know, you said that oatmeal is your usual breakfast, and you make it in the usual way. And yet, you know, there it is, something that I've done 10,000 times, and it's fresh and new. And I think this is that softening that Chad was talking about and Michael highlighted, that this is not about, oh, I need to find a new teacher, or I need to go ahead and do X, Y, and Z. It's actually always right here if we can open to it. And that's what I was hearing from you. You know, opening to the ordinary, fresh and new, right there.
Steve T.
Alan, I very much appreciated you giving us this because it opened up for me a memory which I hold very dear, but I haven't visited in quite a while, which was from the age of 8 till the end of high school. I walked to school every single day of the year that there was school, no matter what the weather was. I always walked. And I think if I go back and think about that period of my life, that walk is almost, it almost eclipses much of the other things, because going the same route every day meant that you experienced it 365 days differently. It never was the same, but there were things that it brought up. I remember that I would always cross behind the block where the bakery was, and I could smell them making the donuts in the morning. It was a very fine smell that has wonderful evocations for me still. I also remember that in the middle of the winter, when it was very cold, I would always shower before I left for school, but sometimes my hair would freeze until it was a solid block sitting on the top of my head, and I'd get to school and it would sort of melt and dribble down. But experiencing the seasons, because every day you were out in the season rather than being separated from it by being inside, was a wonderful thing. And it's this trail is a sort of cast a deep groove in my memory that I appreciate. So thank you very much.
Yeah, beautifully said, Steve. And it brings up a lot for me. And of course, one is that we can continue that practice throughout our lives of being outside every day. if we're lucky, if we don't develop mobility issues or we don't develop severe problems with the cold like chilblains. And even if we do, we can you know, learn to manage that. But also I was moved by your talking about the power of that repeated childhood walk. And it reminded me of, you know, I went to, for a number of years, my elementary school, my junior high school, and my first year of high school were all down the same hill. And I would walk down that hill and back up that hill, just like you, every day, of every school day. And after being away from Seattle for some years, I came back, and as I was coming up that hill, the brightness knob just went way up. It just somehow, all of that mana, you know, all that memory, it was explosive. You know, it was like I was on drugs. It was, and I was not, but it was like that. So that incredible power of repeated outdoor experience and repeated any experience. Thank you for opening that door. Jenny.
Thanks for the talk, Alan. I wanted to defend Changsha a little bit on the autumn, better than the autumn thing. I just saw it a different way when you were talking. That while doing this wandering in the spring, there is like a moment of recognition that brought up this memory of feeling this connected and this open and this out of the way in the autumn. But this is better. This is now. This is better than this memory that comes up.
Yeah, and that's another way that I understand it, which is when it's spring, you know, that is your best season. And when it's autumn, that is your best season. So if he'd been wandering in autumn, that would have been even better than spring with its fragrant grasses and its falling flowers. That I think those are two equally valid ways to understand that. Also, you know, I didn't say anything about Jue Do's kind of comment. Thank you for your answer. But Jue Do can be a little snarky, you know, and thank you for your answer in some Shan and Zen context is what you say in Dharma dialogue when the teacher has responded to your question. The student says, thank you for your answer, and bows. And so I think Jue Do is playing with that a little bit. And thank you for your answer, kind of drawing our attention back to that. What did Changsha mean exactly? So yeah, nice that you have kept it open for us in that way. Thank you for your question.
Thank you for your answer.
Bix.
Yeah, thank you for your talk, Alan. I had, you know, Chad talking about dogs being our teachers, these sort of unexpected teachers that we have. I had this experience. I'm in therapy school, for people who don't know. And one of the clients that I'm working with is only 17 years old, but she has all of this innate wisdom. And we were just talking, most of the individual work that I do with clients these days is transporting, like in transportation. And so I was driving her to where we were going, and she was just expounding the Dharma and like talking about all these Buddhist concepts in non-Buddhist language, and talking about how she sees the whole world as art and what it means to like see the world through the eyes of a child, you know, so much more. And I don't know, I felt the need to share that, like how interesting it is that some people just seem to like understand these things without having done much formal practice at all.
Thanks. Thank you for that. The word picked out really quickly when you said was innate wisdom. And here's the truth that we all have that. We all have that. It's the ability to look at it. I really appreciate Alan going into this idea of the going to the wild places, right? So we can talk about the wild places being the places where there's bears and tigers in the woods, but the wild places are also in our heart. Where are those places that can be kind of seem dangerous or seem like we don't want to go there? Those wild places are where we get to encounter our life and our innate wisdom. And so that's what we do on the cushion. So we could say that wandering in the mountains, we can just as easily do it in Zazen on the cushion, the high places, the low places, the valleys, the peaks, all of that. Opening to that, softening the heart to see all of it come forth. And that is, the innate wisdom we have. We may not be able to put it into words, maybe so eloquently as this person, but we can taste it, we can sense it, because it's available for all of us.
Yeah, and I'm
Now,
also,
go
yeah,
ahead, Paul.
please go ahead, Alan.
Oh, I was going to say, before the Teisho, we said, the Dharma is rarely encountered. And there's some truth to that, in that if we're exposed to the Dharma, to the teachings in this lifetime, how wonderful. We don't want to lose that opportunity. We want to make the most of it. But we can also say the Dharma is often encountered, because again, as Michael said, everyone has this innate wisdom. And so some people are able to dip into it and express it like your therapeutic client did, Bix. And so, these are not truths that are the private property of one sect, but Shakyamuni got these from someplace, and it's the same place that your client got them from, and it's something we can share. However, how wonderful for us that we have this body of teachings that help us to find it and to know what to do with it when we find it, as we also said, to receive and maintain it. Paul.
Yeah, I think this was Alan, you led it in right into to my response, in the sense that that just as Michael is saying, this is innate, and there is this aspect of sudden and gradual that I think this is something, at least for me, I have to be repeated exposed to and tested and checked again and again. And the wisdom is here. Zen is not about Zen. It is about our life. And yet Zen, at least for me, allows me to be awake to all aspects of my life. I thought I knew everything at 17 too. And this client very well may know it, and this aspect of continuing to visit and to revisit, that softening and open heart that we've been talking about, as opposed to certainty. This is the truth. This is, I've got it. Right now. And sit, be with, engage in the world, and see how it unfolds.
Esther.
Thank you for the beautiful talk. I was just in the mountains, way higher than I've ever been. So this wandering back out into the mountains with the monk, or yeah, I always forget the names.
Changsha.
Really where I went with it was, the answers. Where did you go? I was thinking of where it is that we. Where he went in his mind, and where we go in our mind, where I go in my mind to, like, the perhaps going after the green grasses, and this noticing the falling of the flowers that fall even though we love them. Direct parallels in life, perhaps right now, changes with a daughter growing, a period of time ending, the beauty of the falling away. The capacity that we find in ourselves. I was thinking when Steve talked about these vivid memories, this innate capacity we have to, in some way, take it all in, both the frozen hair, the smell of the bakery in the mountains, both the beauty of the snow-covered peaks and the glacier retreating 40 meters in a few years, and how I found this opening to all that there is, both the sadness of changes beyond our control, and also the beauty, both inside, outside.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderfully said, Esther. And yeah, and what's coming up for me is not even so much where did you go in your mind, which is how you put it, but tell me about the meeting of your mind with this wild environment. That's really what the monk wants to know about. Tell me about this meeting of mind and the 10,000 things of mind and the Tao. How did they come together today? Just as you just told us how they came together for you when you were in the Alps. You were in the Alps, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. Madhu, you will have the last word of Zen this morning, so far this morning.
Yeah, I appreciated you talking about wandering and also talking about our sitting practice and, you know, so how all these facets and aspects of our practice is so important. And we sit and we sit and we just sit and then we get out and wander. And then, yeah, and all the, you know, surprises and everything touches us differently after we sit. This is what I constantly notice when we practice and especially during our shishin. And also the wandering practice, how I have noticed that it has opened me up to all the mystery and the awe in the world. And it's also has been a way of cultivating joy and bringing more and more joy. I don't think without this wandering practice, there probably wouldn't have been, I shouldn't say, but, you know, probably would not have been as much mystery and joy as there is in this practice. That's it.
Yeah. There's this thing that twice now I've seen articles about this in the New York Times. There's this thing that people are doing now, which is called, and some therapists recommend this, but it's just generally recommended to do this thing called an awe walk, A-W-E, an awe walk. Go out walking and find something that strikes you with awe. It might just be a bird singing. It might be the ice melting. But what, the first time I've read the first of these articles, I said, all right, that's what we call in Zen going for a walk. And not just one thing, but so much, you know, a piece of litter on the ground can cause awe if you're in that place, that wandering state of mind that is Changsha's state of mind in this koan. That's your state of mind now when you go out walking. And yeah, what a great gift of our practice, the ability to have to have awe coming up at moment after moment, including in our sitting practice. Yeah, feeling of awe at the in-breath, feeling of awe at the out-breath.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this awe walk can be done on the cushion. The wandering can be done on the cushion. Dogen said that when the myriad things come forth and reveal themselves, that's our awakening, right? So we don't have to go anywhere. And we can go someplace, but it's here right now.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone. We'll return to our sitting practice.